I'm happy now to welcome back to the program Peter Crist. He's co-founder of LEAP, which stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's a retired police captain from Tonawanda, New York. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thanks for having me and sharing your audience with me.
So we're talking today to get an update on LEAP, because about once a year I've got somebody from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition on the air. And also, we wanted to lay out some of the issues that we as Santa Feans will be facing as we discuss the decriminalization of marijuana in our city, which is something that is now being brought up. But first, let's talk about LEAP. What is it, and how did you get involved with this work?
Okay, well, interestingly enough for your audience, this year is our 10th anniversary. We formed this organization back in 2002 as a 501c3 nonprofit, which means any money that's donated to us is tax deductible, and that also means that the government knows about us. In fact, the government knows so much about us that this being our 10th anniversary, the federal government of the United States has declared this to be a leap year.
Oh, ho, 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 ho.
I'm not going to get away with that, am I?
No, you are not.
But it is a leap year. What we wanted to do was bring a voice from law enforcement to the discussion at this point in time, primarily on drug policy, but really what LEAP is about is the policy of prohibition. And what we mean by that word, as we use it as a policy description, is the prohibiting of consensual adult activity. When you take things that consenting adults want to do together, for instance, Mary Charlotte, you want to sell heroin. Peter Crist wants to buy heroin. I go to Mary Charlotte, can I buy some heroin? You say yes. I give you money, you give me heroin. We got two happy people, we wander off. These are consenting adults that want to do this activity. When you make that kind of activity illegal, you create crime in your society. And it's interesting, the motive behind banning these drugs was that we wanted to reduce crime, right? Because we claimed that these drugs caused crime and all this other stuff. Well, in reality, when we prohibited it, we created far more crime in a society by instituting a prohibition than the drugs ever created at all. The reason we have the largest prison population on the planet today is because of our prohibition policies. That's filling up almost 50% of the prison cells in America today. And I always throw this in anytime the word prison comes up, just so everybody remembers this. We have the largest, and I would like to state, most efficient prison system on the planet. Nobody hardly ever escapes from one of our prisons. We put you in there, that's where you stay. And in that huge, efficient prison system, we do not have one drug-free prison. So if we cannot keep drugs out of prison, who is going to be delusional enough to think we can keep them out of, drug-free school, whatever you want to mention? But anyways, we formed this organization so that law enforcement could speak to the issue of prohibition in our society. Now, the biggest symbol of prohibition that's going on today, the most visible one, is drug prohibition. So we're focusing most of our efforts on trying to move toward a legalized, regulated, and controlled marketplace. Now, we understand that if we legalize drugs in America, that will not solve our drug problem. Just like when we legalized alcohol in 1933, that didn't end our alcohol problem, but it put a huge dent in our crime and violence problem. In fact, if you go, anybody that wants to do this while they're listening, you can go to the Bureau of Justice Statistics and type in murder rate in America 1900 to present, and you'll see from 1900 until 1920, the murder rate bounces around pretty much about the same. Up and down a little bit every year. By 1920, when we instituted alcohol prohibition, the murder rate started to climb, and it climbed, and it climbed, and it climbed. And by 33, when we ended alcohol prohibition, the murder rate in America peaked. And here's the interesting thing. By 1937, just 4 years after we ended alcohol prohibition, the murder rate in America was back down to the level it was in 1919. Now, I can't give you statistical evidence that can prove that that was associated with alcohol, but I'd like to point out that 1937 was a very dire period of time in America. There were a lot of very angry, unhappy people. Some areas of our country had a 30-40% unemployment rate in 1937. But yet, the murder rate went down because that thing that they were fighting over, that consensual adult activity of one person making beer and the other person wanting to buy it, that was now legal, regulated, and controlled, and we took Al Capone and the gangsters and thugs out of the business. That's what we're talking about by ending this prohibition.
So prohibition is basically the reality of the so-called war on drugs. And I think it's really important when we talk about the war on drugs. We recently had Eugene Jarecki on talking about his film, The House I Live In, which was a fantastic film. And I think it's one of the things that's really important to talk about, and maybe you can speak to this as a former policeman, the alienation of the community from the police that's caused by the drug war. What does this actually look like on the ground?
Well, what it looks like on the ground is the same thing, and it isn't just the drug war. We used to have a pretty active business in this country. It was in almost every major city in America, and it was called the numbers racket. And what that was you would pick certain numbers, and then you would bet a nickel, dime, or quarter, or a dollar on the number, and then there would be a drawing, and you would win. And it was illegal, so the mob ran it. And they had kids. They used to call them runners. And we tried to stamp that out by arresting people, and no matter how many people we arrested, it just kept going. And then one morning we woke up, and it shut down all by itself. That was the day we started the lottery. Because what we did was we changed the name of the numbers racket to the lottery. Same game, same concept, but we took it out of the hands of the gangsters and thugs. And the problem is that a lot of people in those communities used to like to play the numbers racket. And when the cops came around to investigate even another crime, nobody wanted to talk to the cops because they were afraid they were going to be arrested for their gambling or for their drugs or for their other consensual adult activity. So it was better off just not to talk to the cops, and then you didn't have to get into trouble. And that meant when the cops came around and were investigating the rape and the assault, it was still better off just not to talk to cops because they were still arresting people for these other things. You know, I don't think that police officers will ever be as loved in America as firefighters are, because everybody loves firefighters, and you should, because when you have a problem, they come and help you. And here's the big difference between them and police officers. They don't come and tell you when you're doing something wrong. And we need to get police. We'll never be as loved as much as firefighters are, but if you get us out of this consensual crime activity and this kind of enforcement, people will start liking us more, because they won't look us as people that are peeking in their windows telling them how to live their personal lives. They'll look at us as people that are helping them and trying to protect them from other people doing them harm. And that's exactly what I was trained to do. That's what my profession was invented by a guy by the name of Robert Peel over in London with the London Police Department in the early 1800s. The reason he created that organization was to put a group of people in society that would protect people from other people doing them harm, not to stop them from doing things that they chose to do. We have... And I know when you hear the term morality police, you think of places like Egypt or Saudi Arabia or something like that. Well, we currently have morality police in America. In fact, I saw a thing on PBS about a year ago, and there was a thing about the gay issue in America. And at the beginning of the program, it had a blurb on the screen, and it said that in 1960, it was illegal to be gay in every state but Illinois. Now, I don't know why Illinois was smarter than all the rest of them, but that's what the blurb said. Now, when I saw that, I thought to myself, oh, 1960, well, they must have got rid of that law when I started on the police department, because I started there in 1969, and we weren't arresting people for being gay. And then I thought for a second, I remembered, oh, wait a minute. There was a section of the New York State Penal Code, and it was entitled the Consensual Sodomy Law, and it made it illegal for consenting adults to commit sodomy with each other unless they were married. And of course, gay people couldn't be married, so if you caught them doing this, you could arrest them for doing that. And then I thought, well, they must have got rid of that law real quick, and I checked, and you know when we got rid of that law in America or in New York State? 2002.
Good heavens.
Now, that was another morality law.
If I may ask, as a policeman, did you ever actually arrest anybody for sodomy?
I didn't personally, but I know in some areas of the state they were doing that. In parks, they would check out the men's room and stuff like that where people tended to group. And we all know stories about that, about police working those kind of areas. I didn't personally, and in my department, it wasn't a thing that we were that involved in. But it was illegal. And here's another thing. You mentioned about that they're talking locally there about decriminalizing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay, well, here's an interesting thing, and I want everybody to understand that if something is decriminalized, it is still illegal. In my profession in law, when you use the word criminal, if I ask you if you have a criminal record, that means I am asking you if you have ever been convicted of a misdemeanor or a felony. Now, if you have gotten a speeding ticket, which is a violation, or some other a petty larceny thing, which might be a violation, that's a non-criminal charge, but it's still against the law, and you still can be arrested for it. In New York State, you could be sentenced up to a year in jail for non-criminal charges, okay? So when they talk about decriminalizing something, they're not talking about removing this thing from police area of expertise, they're talking about just dropping the level of what the charge is. So you still have police wasting their time and energy instead of running around getting child molesters and people that are assaulting people and stuff like that, wasting their time and energy trying to, and making money on, by the way, we can get into that a little bit, on enforcing consensual adult crime. That is not our function or what we're trained to do.
You still have examples, and I know you've talked about this, and Eugene Jarecki talked about this, like Portugal, which decriminalized drugs, and have had a very positive outcome. And, I mean, it's sort of it seems like, at least for many societies, a kind of halfway measure between legalization and this kind of crazy war, failed war on drugs that we're in. In a place like Portugal, what does it actually look like? What happens?
Basically, first off, you have to understand that no nation that signed the International Drug Control Treaty back in 1972, and the United States and Portugal are signers of that treaty. In that treaty, the United States stuck a section in before everybody signed it, and everybody knew it was there. I'm not saying they snuck it in, but they stuck it in. And it says that none of the signers of this convention are allowed to legalize any of these banned drugs. So what Portugal did was they decriminalized, but basically they legalized because they do not arrest anybody for possession at any level. They do not arrest people. The only thing that they go after are major dealers and stuff like that. One of the interesting statistics that they've seen is a raising of the first age use amongst their youth. It used to be like around 15, 16, now it's up to about 17 or 18 before they first use. In America, it's about 13 or 14, by the way. They've also seen that people are accessing treatment more. The addicts are coming forward and asking for treatment more and actually changing their behavior and stuff. And they're not wasting their time with the 90% of the drug users who are not addicts but are just casual users, just like the 90% of the people that drink alcohol are not alcoholics. They're just casual users of alcohol. And it's the same with all other drugs. We know this statistically. For instance, a lot of people tell me marijuana is legal in Amsterdam, and I always tell them, no, it isn't. It's against the law. They just don't arrest anybody for it, and they allow it to be sold in cafes. But if you look at their law books, it's against the law because nobody wants to violate the international treaty. And in fact, one of the problems that we have here in America now with Colorado and Washington just approving legalized recreational use of marijuana, that violates the international treaty. And that's one of the things that our government has to deal with in this aspect. So there's a lot of other barriers along the way to this. You know, it's funny. I just wonder if in 1915 we had signed an international treaty that said that women would never be given the right to vote. Do you think that would have stopped us in 1920 from giving women the right to vote? Or do you think we would have said, no, that was stupid. Everybody should be able to vote. You know, I mentioned women voting. And there's a couple other things I like to always bring up because they are examples of stupid things that were never good ideas that we did as a free country for extremely long periods of time. Let's look back. We had slavery in this country for almost the first 100 years of our existence. Now, not only was slavery wrong on a moral level, but it was also economically a stupid policy, because economically, it is much better for you to buy 40 hours of my time and then pay me and let me figure out where I'm going to live and what I'm going to eat than it is for you to own me and have to take care of me and give me a roof and fee. That's a terrible economic system. But we did it for 100 years as a free nation, and then we ended it, and what did we replace it with? Another 100 years of segregation. We might have a cure for cancer today if we hadn't segregated our society and pushed people off to the fringes. Who knows what geniuses we lost because of that behavior. And then 150 years as a free nation with women not being allowed to vote. When I'm speaking at a Rotary Club, I mentioned the women voting thing by looking into the audience and saying that I want to thank the women here today because they represent a group of people who studied real hard and finally, by 1920, became intelligent enough to vote. Now, that obviously, as my lovely wife would say, I'm being facetious or feces about that, and either word fits. But women were always intelligent enough to vote. The first time a man voted in this country, there should have been a woman voting right next to him if we meant what we said in the Constitution, but we didn't. And this prohibition is another profoundly stupid thing that we did, first off, for a short period of time between 1920 and 1933 with alcohol. And I want to get that back to that short period of time in a minute. And then we kicked it off again without a constitutional amendment, but with Nixon in the 1970s when he kicked off the drug war and really started pouring money into this thing and everything. The thing I want to mention about alcohol prohibition is we started in 1920 by telling everybody how terrible alcohol was and what a damaging thing it was and how it led to fathers beating their children and what a horrible drug, and we banned it. And then we went through 13 years of alcohol prohibition and we ended it. We legalized alcohol. And you know what? In that, if you look back during that period when they were fighting for repeal, not one person in the repeal movement was defending alcohol. Nobody was saying that, oh, gee, we were wrong. Alcohol's real wonderful stuff. You should give it to your kids. Sorry. Nobody wanted alcohol made legal because they changed their mind about alcohol. The only thing they were saying was they realized the truth, and the truth is, just like today, back then, alcohol did not create Al Capone. Prohibition of alcohol created Al Capone. And as an author said in a newspaper article back in the late 1920s in Chicago, remember one thing, Al Capone doesn't kill people because he's drunk. Al Capone kills people because they're getting between him and his money.
Right,
and the
right.
only reason that was his money is because we prohibited it and gave the marketplace to him. And we're doing the same thing with cartels that have killed over 60,000 people in Mexico in the last 10 years. We have drive-by shootings in America on our city streets. All this violence. And the press keeps calling it drug-related violence. And it's very interesting because if you look back to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, 1929, nobody in America called that an alcohol-related shooting. They all knew that it wasn't somebody got drunk or high on drugs and killed these people. It was people fighting over the marketplace. And we, by a choice that we have made as a society, we have given gangsters, thugs, and terrorists this marketplace. There's one question I ask every audience I speak to, and I'll throw it out there to your audience, too. Just let them ponder it. If you believe that we can win the war on drugs, and let's understand what winning a war means. We won the Second World War. That means that it's over. We don't fight the Japanese and the Germans and the Italians every couple months or so. The war is over. We won it. It is done. So if we win the war on drugs, that means that the drugs are gone. We don't have to worry about them anymore. They're done. And I ask my audiences, and I've asked this of thousands of people at least over the last 6 months. Raise your hand if you think that's possible, and not one hand has gone up. Not one thinks that that can be done. So then that changes the whole discussion. Then we stop talking about drug-free because we realize that's not possible, and we have to say drugs are always going to be a part of our society. Who do you want to control the marketplace? Gangsters, thugs, and terrorists, or legitimate business people with age limits and purity controls, the same kind of thing we have for alcohol and tobacco? Which sounds more sensible to you?
We're talking to Peter Crist from LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. You've been saying so many things that I want to respond to a lot of them, but let's do them one at a time. I mean, there's obviously a relationship between the vast poverty and inequality that we have in this country and the drug business. I mean, drug dealing becomes a business that arises in neighborhoods where there just simply isn't the education or the opportunity for young people to actually do something that would be more fulfilling to them and more lucrative to them, and this drug business is there. And it seems like in the whole question of drugs, in addition to what you're talking about, it seems like proper education in this and opportunity in this country would also make a difference in dealing with some of the violence, some of the addiction problems that we're looking at.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely true. And if we weren't spending $40 billion a year to $70 billion a year on this drug policy, maybe we would have some money to do exactly what you're saying. There's another aspect of this drug war that lays way back at the roots of it. All of our drug laws that we have ever made in this country from the late 1800s until present have been pointed at and directed at minorities. For example, the first anti-opiate laws ever passed in America were on the West Coast, and they were passed against the Asians that were coming to America that we didn't like for work and jobs and a life and a career, and they were bringing their drug of choice with them from Asia, which was opium, and we couldn't make them illegal, so we made their drug illegal. Now, let's drop down south a little bit, and we drop down to the first anti-marijuana laws we saw, and lo and behold, where were they? In the Southwest. And who were they directed against? The people that were coming up from South America and Mexico and bringing their drug of choice with them, marijuana, and we couldn't make those people illegal, so we made their drug illegal. Little different twist, we move now east, stay south. And we see the first cocaine laws in the 1920s. And the articles in the newspapers said things like, those black jazz musicians are stealing the white women with their white powder. Those were the things that they were talking about on why they had to ban cocaine. And then here's the one that everybody misses, alcohol prohibition. And I have people say to me, alcohol prohibition, racial, come on, Peter, you're going too far now. And I said, really? Let's look back at our history. In the late 1800s, early part of the 20th century, we had a period in this country that was referred to as the Protestant Reformation. And it was a big resurgence of Protestantism, and the church is taking power, electing people to government and stuff like that. And there were two groups of people those Protestants of that day did not like. And those people were called Catholics, and those people were called Jews. And pouring in through Ellis Island at the beginning of the 20th century were Italian and Irish Catholics and Western European Jews. And we made their drug, alcohol, illegal. And who were the gangsters and thugs of alcohol prohibition? Italian, Irish, and Jews. And this isn't something genetically wrong with those people. This is our social system. My mother, who was born in 1904, I remember telling me that she remembers reading in the Buffalo newspaper on ads, you know, one ads, and they would say, man needed to do work, da-da-da-da-da-da, and the last line of the ad would say, Catholics need not apply. That was in the newspaper. Right. And let's not forget how many Catholic presidents we've had. And even in 1960, the big hubbub about a Catholic can't be president, he takes orders from the Pope. I mean, I remember that. I was alive during that period. So that was still residual leftover stuff from that period. So we have always used these kind of prohibitions, these morality prohibitions. We claim we're doing it to help people, but in reality, we're destroying more lives by the prohibition. We have a saying at LEAP, and that is, you could recover from your addiction. You never recover from your conviction. You get convicted of a charge, and that conviction goes with you to every job interview you go to. And people generally, if they got a choice between somebody that's never been to prison and somebody who has been, most people will take the person that hasn't been, you know? So it's harder to get work. This is what we're doing for people. Secondly, I want to tell you something about this huge prison system we got that maybe will wake some people up in this country. 90% of the people in our prison system, actually it's a little bit over 90%, but roughly 90% of the people in our prison system have one thing in common, and that is they are coming home. Only under a little bit under 10% of them are in there for life. All the rest are coming home. Now, whether they've been away for 5 to 7 years or 10 to 15 or 25 to 30, they're coming home. Now, you have to ask yourself, in this huge, overcrowded, unmanageable prison system we have in this country, how much correction are we doing? Zero. We're actually sending these people back home worse than we got them because we're so overcrowded, we can't really do anything about changing their behavior. So we have that pending, too, as they're coming back and can't get jobs. And the only thing left for them is this underground marketplace to make a living off of. And then the cycle just continues and just continues and just continues. You know, if this worked, I think it would have started working a few years ago, don't you? We've been doing it now since the 1970s. I mean, how long does a policy have to fail before people realize that it was the idea that was a stupid thing? I have people say to me, well, you know, if you people in law enforcement would arrest these people, we wouldn't have this problem. And I tell people, we have the largest prison system in the world. Do you really believe that these people are turning themselves in? We're arresting them as fast as we can get our hands on them. And just one other little thing about who these dirty, no-good, scummy drug users are, let's remember that if we in law enforcement over the last 40 years had been 100% effective in law enforcement for drug enforcement, we would not have had the last three presidents of the United States because all of them admit to using illegal drugs. I'm sorry, Bill Clinton just passed it, but that's illegal too, so he would have been arrested for that. So, I mean, let's at least be honest about it. Let's at least be honest about who we are. In fact, one of the things, Paula and I, my lovely wife, are celebrating next month our 40th anniversary. And we didn't have children. And all my friends did have children. And I promised all my friends that I would maintain for them any lie about their past that they told their children until their youngest turned 21, and then all bets are off. And
like
I got a lot of very nervous friends out there when I'm around their kids today, because they're all over 21 now.
I mean, are you saying that their biggest lie is drug use?
Well, for most of them, yeah.
Well, that's not
absolutely
so bad. I can think of
worse. No, it isn't terrible. I mean, believe me, it isn't like their biggest lie was that they were a rapist or a bank robber or something. It's drug use, but they've been lying to their kids for years about it. And they're successful people. And most of them that are lying to their kids about it never stopped. I don't mean stop lying. I mean stop using.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the thing. There's so much hypocrisy around this. And I think that a lot of this is coming to the surface right now because in the last election, there were a couple of states that legalized the use of marijuana. And let's look at communities where marijuana is used. I mean, alcohol prohibition, the reality is that alcohol, 90%, as you say, of the people who use alcohol are not abusing it. They're drinking a beer in the, we have these wonderful brew pubs here in Santa Fe, you know, drinking beer with their friends, and they're drinking wine over dinner, and there's a whole culture surrounding these things. And I've been noticing, as a lot of people have, that marijuana also seems to have kind of a culture, and there are people growing it in California who are connoisseurs of 97 different kinds of this particular plant. What actually happens in these communities where there is cultural, vast majority, non-addictive use of, for example, marijuana? I mean, what happens? Does everybody just get stupider and eat more potato chips? I mean, what does it look like?
No, it looks the same way as it looked always before, except that now when people go home at the end of the day, instead of having a Manhattan, they might have a toke. Okay, and then they go to sleep, they get up the next morning, they go all about their work and do what they do because they're responsible people. And when they decide they want to get together with friends and relax, they relax with a little something they smoke or whatever, or snort. It isn't just, you know, understand the addiction rate for all drugs, except for one drug. The addiction rate for all drugs is about 10 to 15% of the people who use it are addicts.
What's the other one?
The off-the-chart one is tobacco. And the addiction rate for tobacco is, in fact, going down. We used to say it was 90%. And think about it. Back years ago, everybody you know that smoked always had a full pack of cigarettes in their pocket. They smoked, they always had a pack of cigarettes, right? They didn't just meet somebody that had a cigarette and have a cigarette once in a while. If they smoked all the time. Now you're starting to see more people that quit smoking, but every once in a while, if they're around people that smoke, they'll have a little hit, or they'll have a cigarette. You never used to see that before. There was either the smokers or the non-smokers. Now we're starting to see the emergence of the casual smoker. And I believe that the reason why the addiction rate on tobacco was so high is because we socially not only accepted it, but we socially supported it. Let me give you an example. World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War. Every K-ration package, that's every little food package that a soldier got, had a pack of cigarettes in it. You could smoke anywhere. You could get on an aeroplane 15 years ago in New York City and fly all the way to L.A. smoking all the way.
Right, in the smoking section.
Exactly, yeah. But and the only thing that separated the smoking section from the other section was a sign.
Right.
There wasn't even a curtain, okay?
And it was that way in restaurants until fairly recently in Santa Fe, and even in dance clubs, it was a disaster because you would try to go dancing and somebody would be smoking, and that's gone now. It's great.
Exactly. And what the thing is what we changed about smoking is, first off, we started honestly educating the public about it, and secondly, we started doing something we learned from the Amish, and that is we started shunning the smokers. I'm sorry, if you want to light that up, you'll have to go outside. And that made it more difficult. And in the last 10 years, we have got 50% of the adult cigarette smokers to quit smoking cigarettes. They just did a study of high school seniors, and they asked them, have you smoked a cigarette in the last 30 days? And 12% said yes. And then they asked them, have you smoked marijuana in the last 30 days? And 21% of them said yes.
Oh, my goodness. You see, this is what you're outlining is a kind of vision of not only what is actually happening, but changes that happen in society. And so, I mean, people are so kind of scared of drugs, and I think they're less scared of marijuana right now because it's just clearly so relatively benign, even compared to alcohol. But when you look at marijuana or any other drug or alcohol or tobacco, there will be a period where people use it and then where they are shunned or where they just end up thinking it's stupid or where they don't want to do it anymore in a context of legality. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know how I feel about the legalization of heroin or methamphetamine, because it seems to me that there aren't a whole lot of people who use those drugs recreationally who don't get addicted or who don't get messed up by them. Do you have a different perspective on those kind of harder drugs?
Yes, it's 90% of the people that use heroin never become addicted.
Is that right?
Let me explain something to you about addiction. And we have two models for addiction in this country. The one that has been dominant is that drugs cause addiction, that it's a disease, it's brought to you by the drug. The one that is starting to emerge, by the way, it also happens to be the truth, is that drugs do not cause addiction. We have people who have addictive behavior within them, and they take it sometimes to drugs. Or, for instance, like our former drug czar, William Bennett, who was addicted to slot machines. And it was an addiction. He compulsively kept playing the slot machines. That is compulsive behavior. And we take it to a drug. We call it addiction. And then, you know where the first time the medical profession started calling an addiction a disease was? In the 1920s. And you know what country it was in? America. And you know why American doctors started calling addiction a disease? Because alcohol was illegal, and they didn't want to look at their alcoholic patients as being criminals, so they said they were diseased. So we created the disease model for addiction. And in reality, addiction is a behavior. It is a choice that we make. And if you don't think it's a choice, tell me one other disease you can choose not to have. And for addiction, that is recovery, is choosing not to have. So it is. If it's a disease, it is the only disease that the way you end it is by making a different choice.
Well, that's true. And at the same time, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into that, and there are some physiological factors that go into alcohol that don't go into, for example, marijuana. But, I mean, I think there's also something that needs to be talked about that we haven't talked about, which is that there is a relationship between drug use and drug abuse and addiction and people's lives and the, again, going back to poverty, going back to the extent that people are using drugs to actually escape from their lives, because life is not so rosy in many, many communities in this country.
90% of our heroin-using soldiers that used heroin in Vietnam, 90% of them stopped using heroin when they got off the plane and came home. Without treatment, without 10% had an addiction problem, they had to get some help. When I mention addiction's a choice, don't misunderstand me. I am not saying that treatment isn't necessary. I'm not saying that counselors aren't necessary. I have had to make some choices in my life throughout my 66 years that I have needed support and help from other people to help me make the right choice. So I'm not saying that you don't need external people helping you and stuff like that. Some people do. But let's not make the lie that the drug causes addiction. That is a lie. People bring their addiction to the drug, and they can bring it to anything if they choose to. And we have to be at least honest about that.
Let's talk for a moment about, I mean, there's something that I think is a little difficult to sort out. On the one hand, you have the drug war, the so-called war on drugs, being kept in place by lobbies who are benefiting. So you've got the private prisons, which we've talked about numerous times on this program, and you've got giant infrastructures which are benefiting from the prohibition on drugs. And you have communities whose main source of income is, in fact, a prison. And if you were to have a sane and rational drug policy, a lot of those prisons would close, or they would have to scale way down. And a lot of people who supply this sort of militarized police force and all of that would lose their income. On the other hand, you'd have vast amounts of money that would suddenly be available because the taxpayers are no longer footing the bill for this war on drugs. So how do you understand the big economic picture?
Well, you nailed it right on the money. There are vested interests, and vested interests are not just drug dealers. We have created, as you said, and because you've talked about it many, many times on the show, I won't go into it too much, but we have a private prison industry that is growing in this country. So we have made it profitable for people to deprive American citizens of their liberty. They can make money off of that. That should never be a profit-making business in a country that has a bell and a statue in the harbor of New York celebrating liberty, and then we make people making money off of it. Another aspect of this comes from the criminal justice system, and that comes from the forfeiture statutes. And I'm not talking about, there's two types of forfeiture, and forfeiture is where the criminal justice system takes your property or your money. The one kind is criminal forfeiture, and that is if I arrest you for a crime, if I arrest you, let's say, for a series of bank robberies that you got a lot of money from, and when I arrest you, you got a garage behind your house that's got a bunch of old, real expensive cars in it that you had bought with this money. Once I convict you of those bank robberies, I seize those cars and sell that and then give that money back to the people that you stole it from or whatever. That's criminal forfeiture, and that I don't have any problem with. But here's another thing we have in America. It is called civil forfeiture. And that's when the officer takes your property, your car, or your money, and doesn't even arrest you for anything, much less seek a conviction, but just makes an accusation that you were in this neighborhood or you had that money to buy drugs, and then you have to sue the police department in order to get your money back, and you have to prove you weren't there to buy drugs. Now, that's something that has evolved out of this drug war. And if that was happening in any other country on the planet, we would call that criminal on the government's part. And yet we're doing it to people every day in America. And the reason we're doing it is to keep people off of drugs. We're just trying to help people because the drugs are so terrible. So we're going to take all their money and turn them into a poverty-stricken person and put them in prison and give them a felony conviction just to show them how bad these drugs are. What? What did I miss?
Well, so let's talk about it from the other side. Let's say you were to end prohibition tomorrow and you were to have some kind of system where every single drug was manufactured and sold legally and there were age limits and all kinds of things that would prevent it from getting into the hands of 9-year-olds and so on. And you would cut way down on the prison populations because people wouldn't be in there for smoking marijuana or selling it and things like that. And the civil forfeiture, all that stuff goes away. What does this country then begin to look like economically? Because this is a huge change. There's a lot of math involved and a lot of change in that
math. Yeah. Well, economically, for one thing, it is not. I don't think there's a person listening to this program that thinks that the federal government would legalize drugs and not tax the living hell out of them. Okay?
Right.
So for the first thing, we would save a bunch of money on the prisons we would be closing and all that other stuff. And here's another suggestion I got. How about we cut our prison population in half? We shut down half of the prison buildings that we have, rip them down and build whatever, I don't know, apartment complexes for people that have jobs and want to live someplace. But how about this? How about we don't fire one prison guard? How about we keep the same number of prison guards, only retrain them to educate these people that are locked up so that when they're sending them back home in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, they're actually sending them home better than they got them rather than just incarcerated for that period of time? And
right.
Secondly, look at the money we not only save domestically by not enforcing these laws, but the foreign money we are blowing by giving money to governments to fight the drug war and all this other ridiculous garbage. And none of it's working. According to the UN, 3 years ago, they came out with a study and said that the international drug trade is a $500 billion a year business. You tell any good capitalist out there that there's $500 billion laying out there, but don't touch it because it's illegal. And I think that maybe some of them might say, I'll take a chance because there's just too much money in it.
We're talking to Peter Crist from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. So, again, coming back to Santa Fe, what do you say to parents who are afraid that their kids might start using drugs or using them more openly or be smoking weed instead of doing their homework if marijuana were decriminalized?
Well, what I will tell all the parents out there about their kids using drugs is they won't find out if their kids use drugs probably unless they get arrested until their kids are 25 years old, and then they'll probably admit it. But until then, they'll just keep lying to their parents like they're doing now. There is nothing about the current policy now that is stopping their children from using illegal drugs. Nothing. Nothing. There isn't a person listening on this radio right now, whether they have ever used an illegal drug or not, that can't, and I don't care what city or what area of America they live in, that cannot walk out their front door, and if they try real hard, within 24 hours, come back home with an illegal drug. Nobody is incapable of doing that. And the difference is, at least under a regulated marketplace, we might be able to set some limits and stop kids from using drugs. In an illegal marketplace, we got 13-year-old children selling drugs on street corners.
The drug war has been going on for so long that generations of law enforcement, police and judges and so on, have really bought into it and they believe in it. What kinds of conversations are you having with working law enforcement today? I know that you're a retired police captain, and a lot of the people who are involved in law enforcement against prohibition are also retired. What about the people who are on the streets, on the benches now? What kind of conversations are you having with them?
Let me give you a conversation I had with my old boss. I worked with this guy for 20 years. He was the chief of police in my community that I worked in. He was in charge of the 120 police officer department I worked in. We were very good friends. It's about 6 months after he retired. I'm back in town. I called him up on the phone. I said, "You want some company?" He says, "Yeah, stop over." So I stop over at the house. We're sitting there in his living room chatting and talking. And I'm in the middle of saying something, and I see on his face what we used to call the look. And I knew as soon as I saw that look, he was going to say something. So I interrupted him. I said, "What?" He says, "How long have we been arguing about this drug legalization garbage years?" I said, "Well, we've known each other for 25 years. I guess we've been arguing about it for 25 years. And he says, "You're right." This is 6 months after he retired. I said, "I'm what?" He says, "You're right." And then he said, "I don't know if it's the old forest for the trees thing." He says, "But I was involved in it. It was my job. That's what I did." He said, "But just after being out for just a couple months, I look back on it, and I see the futility of it. I see what it's doing to our profession, how it's hurting our ability to do other police work." And he says, "I realize now that you're right. You're right." So you get that kind of stuff. You also have true believers that are never going to see it different. You know, they're going to think that it's the power of government. It always amazes me that you get Ann Coulter. She is absolutely against drug legalization. So let me interpret Ann Coulter this way. Ann Coulter believes that the government is the most evil thing in the world, that we got to get the government out of people's lives, the government shouldn't be touching our money, they shouldn't be doing this, they shouldn't be doing this. But that government should tell you what drugs you can and cannot take. Now, does that sound like a government that you want?
Right. But getting back to, I mean, you just talked about your police chief who retired, but what about your conversations with people who haven't retired?
Well, the ones that are still in the job, a lot of them are still on, you know, on the beam. They think I'm crazy. They think you're nuts. A lot of them get it, but it's their job, and that's what they have to do, and they took an oath. I have got comments on both sides of the issue. I've got comments from presentations I've done that there have been working local law enforcement people there, and they've come up to me on the side and said, "Keep up the good work. Get us out of this." Because they understand, and they understand that it isn't even about the drug thing. They understand the fundamental principle of prohibiting consensual adult behavior, and they understand how that interferes with their ability to be able to do their job.
Peter Crist is co-founder of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's a retired police captain from Tonawanda, New York. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you very much for sharing your audience with me again, and we'll see. Talk to you again, I'm sure.